of Helene and Bernhard. This is May 14th, 1992, and it is now 7:40 in the evening, and I am about to have a conversation with Bert Bernhard. Bert has been very prominent in the Jewish community for many, many years. His contribution has not only been noted in the Jewish community, but in the general community as well. And for this reason, and for his charm and gentlemanless qualities that he has, I would like very much to have a conversation with Bert Bernhard on this evening, May 14th, 1992. Hello, Bert.
Good evening, Florence.
Well, you and I have known one another for a long time, haven't we?
A long time. I think it goes back to repertory plays.
It does. Do you remember what year that was?
I can only give you an idea. It must have been about before 1940.
Oh, definitely before 40.
Because I came here in 1931.
You came to Providence in 1931.
That's right.
Now, why did repertory start? What was the reason for it?
Very good question.
We should explain what repertory players was, I think.
Yeah, repertory players was... Well, first let me tell you how it started, and then I think it would be self-explanatory. Somebody made the suggestion that we should put on a play for the Home for the Aged and sell tickets and raise money. And I think I was president at the time of a group of people. Well, I later became president. And I said, who do you think will spend money to see a bunch of amateurs put on a very amateurish production? Well, what do you suggest? I said, why not form the repertory players in which we would have coaches to teach the people who wanted to be actors or actresses and subsequently to put on a play for the Home for the Aged or for any other charitable group. And that's how the repertory players was born.
Was this a kind of Jewish answer, a Jewish counterpart to the players?
Hardly. The players, the Barker players, have been in operation for many, many years. The only connection we had is we use members of the Barker Playhouse with Mrs. Sweet, Bill Smith, and some of those people as our coaches.
But there weren't many Jews in the players in those days.
No, there wasn't.
No. So in a sense, it was a kind of Jewish counterpart, I would think. I remember I was in a couple of plays, or several plays at repertory. I remember it very well.
But we did put on, you know, some three-act plays after a while. And I might say they were put on at the Barker Playhouse, and I think they were quite successful.
They were great.
I never was an actor. I was the producer.
Well, you were more important. You played a more important part, Bert. You were the producer and the coordinator and the organizer, and you showed all those talents even then. When you came to Providence in 1931, was it because you had... met Helene, or you were met? What happened?
Well, let me tell you how that happened. I was with my folks, my mother and father, on a vacation in Bethlehem, New Hampshire. And I used to do a lot of horseback riding because near our home in Boston, there was a stable, and I used to go out and help them exercise horses. So I went down to this stable and told them I'd done some riding, and I'd like to hire a horse. Well, they brought out a horse that hadn't been out in service for at least 2 weeks. And I get on the horse, and he was very skittish, but he responded very nicely. And I came up this hill towards the hotel where my mother and a friend of hers, Rose, somebody from Taunton, I remember, was sitting on the veranda of the hotel.
Do you remember what the name of the hotel was? Because there were some very famous hotels in...
Yeah, this is one of the good ones, but I don't remember. No. We could look it up, probably, and find out. Helene keeps very good records of these things, although I didn't know Helene then.
Ah.
But the women were sort of rocking back and forth. when they happened to see me riding up on this horse, up this hill. And this woman from Taunton said, "Doesn't that young man ride that horse beautifully?" Well, my mother's bosom expanded, the buttons flew off, and she says, "That's my son." Well, that started talking about girlfriends. No, I didn't have any girlfriends. But
you must have been very young at that time.
I was about 20, 21, I think. I mean, I had girlfriends, but I didn't have a steady girlfriend, let's put it that way. So this woman said, "Well, I have a friend of mine, and she's spending the summer at this resort hotel just on the outskirts of Bethlehem. And maybe you'd like to meet her. She's a blonde." Well, I only took blondes out. I don't know why, but I only took blondes out. That intrigued me. So one day we were out riding, my folks and I, and I stopped at this hotel, and Helene was just coming off the golf course, dressed in white. And I introduced myself, told her how I happened to be there, and I said, "I'd like to contact you sometime and get to know you." She didn't say yes, she didn't say no, but I did call her in Providence later on, and she said, "All right, come on down." Now, this was in the middle of winter by this time, and very cold, and several times riding down or back from Boston to Providence, my car froze over. It wasn't my car, it was my father's car. And I would have to take a blanket and throw it over the hood and warm it up until we got the thing going, until I got the thing going, so I could get back to Boston. But I suddenly started to take a very great interest in seeing Helene, and I came down and finally and said to her and said I would like to talk to her father, and asked if I could have the hand of Helene.
They don't do that anymore.
No, I don't think so. And he said, well, she's agreeable, we're agreeable, but why don't you just try it on a term basis, you might say. And that was about November. Well, in April, her father passed away. Oh. We were going to be married in June at the old Ledgemont Club. What was to be a 200 guest affair turned out to be rather interestingly enough, we were married in not Rhode Island, but in Massachusetts. And why? Because the rabbi, the Reform rabbi that we would use to marry us, was given a paper in Cincinnati. And when we went to see him about performing the ceremony, he wanted us to change our time. I couldn't change my time. I was then working in the investment business, just started. And, I started actually 2 years before, but it was a very bad time right after that big break. So the only way we could do it was to get the legislature of Rhode Island to agree that we bring in a rabbi from out of town, and we didn't want to do that because there was no other rabbis that we could use at that time. And so we finally decided to bring my rabbi down, Rabbi Abrams from Ohava Shalom in Boston, and we came down to North Attleboro. Mm-hmm. We were married at the Hotel Hickson.
In North Attleboro.
In North Attleboro. So actually, we were married in Massachusetts, which he could perform. And
Massachusetts loss was Rhode Island's gain, certainly.
Well,
so you were in the investment business when you came to college.
I started in 1929, just after I graduated from Boston University.
Right after the Depression. I mean, in the height of the Depression, wasn't
just,
it?
Just a month or two before that big break came, and people were saying to me, when the market started to go topsy-turvy, "What's happened?" I don't know what happens. I haven't been through this before. All I can remember is seeing bodies flying out of the window.
Really? Ashley, you actually saw them?
I actually saw them. From above us. We were on the ninth floor, and there were floors above us at Mill Street, downtown. And I actually saw a couple of bodies.
Jump?
Well, I didn't see them jump. I saw them pass the window outside.
Mm.
Because in those days, you could buy on margin. And the margin was 10%. Today it's 50%. And where did they get their information from? When they wanted to get a shoe shine, they would sit in a chair and the bootblack would give them a tip. And on that tip, they would invest money and buy on margin. And a lot of people went broke. They lost everything they had. And lost a lot of businesses, too.
So when you came to Providence, you started with an investment.
When I came to Boston, to Providence, I'm sorry, there was a fellow that preceded me by several years. His name was Saul Rothstein. He was a Bostonian. He'd come down here, and he approached me and said, how would you like to open an investment brokerage firm with me? Well, I was happy to have anything. And so we formed the firm of Rothstein and Bernhardt. And Saul was a marvelous person to work with. He was one of the smartest men I've ever known in the investment business. But then I got an opportunity to go with Apex. This was right at the time of the war. And if you remember Irving Fain, he enlisted, but he wanted to run the army the way he wanted to, not the way the army wanted it. However, I got a call from Al Pilovan to take his place. They wanted somebody that they could trust, I suppose. And Helena had been a bridesmaid at their wedding, Selma and Al. And so
I... We were all friends.
We were all friends and close friends. And I said I'd go with them for 1 year. 33 years later,
really,
I decided to go back in the investment business. Now, don't forget, that was from 1944 to... It was before that, 1944, and 33 years. It was 1974 I came back, so it was 41, actually.
What did you do at Apex?
I was in the factory.
Oh.
And I was vice president of the company, and my job was to take care of about 50 reps, representatives, or sales force. And I had to travel a good deal. I got to the point where I traveled too much, and I said, I'm giving you my 6 months notice. I'm going back in the investment business. So I came back in the investment business in 1974. And I went with a firm called G.H. Walker. And why G.H. Walker? Because Clark Simons was the manager. And he and I were good friends. We worked together on some of the campaigns, fundraising campaigns, which I'd like to tell you about afterwards. And he said, Bert, I want you to take this information and study it so that you can pass the exam. I never took an exam to sell securities up until that time. But if I nowadays you had to be a member of a stock exchange, I studied, and it wasn't easy, going
at
back
that
to the
point,
books.
Right.
But I thought I was pretty well versed. When he called me on New Year's Eve, Bertie says, I got some good news for you. The stock exchange has granted you what they call the grandfather clause, which means that you're exempt from taking the exam because of your prior experience. So I never did pass the New York Stock Exchange. I since have taken exams for, I think, 7 states where I do business, anywhere from Rhode Island down to Florida, and into Washington, D.C., and Philadelphia. So I am licensed to do business in all of those particular states, because we can't legally do business in any states that we are not registered. So then from being with Clark Simons, we went with White Whale, took us over. And then Merrill Lynch took us over. And then we became Drexel Burnham. And then Smith Barney, where I'm now associated, just changed the name on the door and took over from Drexel when they got into difficulties.
You had to change the stationery a lot.
Yeah, well, they did very easily. Just a question of putting another name on it. And that's where we are now. And
how's business?
Believe it or not, it's good.
Good.
Yeah, really is. It's surprising. There are a lot of people who want to be in the market, have funds. Unfortunately, they want to buy at the low and sell at the high. That's a myth. You never buy at the low and you sell at the high. However, these people have accumulated a bunch of money that they want to put to work, and they know one of these days they think there's going to be a break in the market, which...
Do you think it
could
will?
Be. Well, it could be, because they're up. The Dow Jones average is up to almost 3,500. It's a new high.
Mm-hmm.
And it could break temporarily for a short time and then resume the upper market. However, if the federal government decides to lower interest rates again, I don't think it's going to go off as much or for as long as people think. And it will resume the upward trend. I think the market's a good buy right now, yes.
We'll make a note of that.
Okay.
Now, coming back to your life in the community, was Repertory Players your first stint in the way of organizations?
No. I think one of the first things I did was worked for the Bethel Brotherhood. I became president, ultimately. And also the Home for the Aged. They used to have outdoors...
bazaars?
It wasn't a bazaar. It was almost like a
fair?
Yeah, it was all kinds. They would have a lot of entertainers there, and they had different booths where they were selling things, and we were raising money. That's really my first fundraising that I did here.
Mm-hmm.
And
where was the home then? At what point was this?
It was where it is now.
On Hillside Avenue?
On Hillside Avenue, but it didn't have all the buildings.
No.
And they had to put up a tent alongside towards the Providence End, and booths, and we were all volunteers, and we had a lot of fun.
How many people did they have at the home in those days? You have any idea? How many residents they had?
I would say...
Approximately?
Approximately, maybe they had 100.
They did have that many?
I think so.
Mm.
I did think so.
Now, why did you pick the home as an organization for you to work on?
Well, I like to work. My father... in Boston, when he was alive, had done a lot of this so-called fundraising for charity. I came by it naturally, and I don't know how I got into it. Somebody, I suppose, asked me to do it, and just like in subsequent years, when I got involved with the Temple Bethel, I remember Rabbi Gutterman coming to me one evening and said, "Bert, we would like you to become chairman of the Bethel Benefit, didn't know the Benefit, the Temple Bethel fundraiser." And I said, "Well, I'll be glad to work on it under one condition, and that is that Norman Fain will be my co-chairman." Well, Norman agreed. And we had the initial affair at the University Club, in which we invited 40 couples to be our guests for dinner. And then we get up and we explain to them what we had in mind. And this group was to be sort of a, well, it was going to be a, not only a fundraising, but also because, as it turned out, the name was Benefactors, we want to do something for the community. And it was subsequently, it did just that. Now, that night, we asked people to make one pledge and pay $10,000. That's the only figure we had. And 14 people agreed. It's today 22, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the interest from that fund is being used to bring on some of the outstanding
personalities.
For example, we had Madame Sadat, we had Henry Kissinger, and the other night we had Roberta Peters before, and the other night we had Theodore Bickel.
Mm.
Now, there was no charge to the members or the public. Our members got, of course, the first opportunity to have tickets, and if there are any additional tickets available, the community was invited. And last week we had about 1,500 people here to hear Bickel.
It was marvelous. I was there.
Wasn't it good?
It was. Well, what was so wonderful about it was the excitement, I think, of all these people coming under one roof that particular night. There's an excitement about a big crowd in one place.
And you know, Bickel is not a young man, eh?
No. No, Bickel isn't. I remember many years ago we were in Israel and he stayed at the same hotel.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he stayed at the same hotel.
Well, this is the second time the temple had him. We had him 10 years ago. I found out afterwards that at this time, he's 68.
Really?
Mr. Brown, I didn't think he was that old.
I didn't either.
Yeah, but don't forget, he was the lead on quite a few plays. And
well, it was a wonderful thing that you did, because it offers the community an opportunity to hear people that normally they might not ever have the chance to hear.
Well,
But how did you hit on this particular idea?
Well, I guess it was between Norman and myself to come up with an idea, and we had to get people to pay $10,000, we had to give them something. We had to give them a name, and this name, Benefactors, was going to mean that they would be on the programs forever.
True, and the name Benefactor is a beautiful word, because you're doing something so very worthwhile.
That's right, and we did have some unusual...
Now, you've always been involved with the temple, haven't you, Bert?
Ever since
you came to Providence.
Yes,
and in Boston,
I became a member of the temple in 1931, the year I was married.
Now, let me ask you, you know, and I know, many people who are not affiliated with the temple. You know, I'm sure, many people who wouldn't go near the temple. Or if they do go to the temple, it's just a perfunctory thing, you know. It's what makes you so involved in the temple? Is it your religious conviction or what?
Well, no, I can't say it was my religious conviction, because I belonged to Ahava Shalom when I was in Boston.
What denomination? What is that? Conservative? Ahava Shalom?
No, it's Reform.
Is it?
But towards some of the conservative. And this one here is strictly Reformed. Now, I became president first of the Brotherhood, and then I moved on and became an officer of the temple. I was on the board, and ultimately they elected me president. At that time, a president could serve 5 1-year terms, 5 years, and that's too much for anybody. And after I concluded my 5 years, I insisted they change it to 3 years, and they agreed, and they changed the bylaws. So it was only 3 years. But that particular time, they needed leadership to raise funds to build a new temple. We came, don't forget, from Broad Street over here to Orchard Avenue. And Wallace Sundman was called back to be a president for the second time during that period so we could raise the funds and also build a temple. And people like Abe Klein also was very helpful. The man who really supervised the building and did something that very few people knew how to do was Norman Fain again. He's had a tremendous amount of experience, and he worked very hard to see that everything was done right. And I became an honorary president after that, and I guess all the other presidents did. Now, Bruce Sundman, who's now governor of the state, wanted to become president because his father was president at least 2 times. And Bruce came to me one day and he says, Bert, he says, we've got to raise $130,000 during my
presidency.
And he says, I want to leave something here that people will remember. Well, I thought about it, and I said, you've got a lot of younger people here. Why don't you take advantage? No, no, you've had the experience, he says. Well, I got together with Norman, but Norman wasn't able to take it at the time. So I suggested another man who was new to our temple, Dave Cohen, Pat's husband. And he took it, more because I think Pat urged him to, and she was on the board, and did a very good job. And we got together with President Sundman at the Hope Club for a breakfast meeting. And we had no idea what we were going to raise, how to do it. So I said, we got to have a gimmick. Well, what do you mean by having a gimmick? Well, we've got to be able to get people to pay whatever sum we set to be a sponsor. And one of the members of the committee suggested that we have a $1,000 sponsorship payable over 4 years, $250 a year. That was enticing. And then Bruce Sundman said, would it be any help if I offered my home in Newport for the opening's attraction? We liked it, and over 200 people attended. And we ended up with raising $330,000, not $130,000, $330,000. And that has gone for a lot of things. Number one, to give the people on the staff more money, and to set up a pension fund for them. Also to give our rabbi, Delaman, a purse for 20 years of service. And also because a book on the Temple Bethel was being written, and that was going to be given with their name on the cover of each person that became a sponsor as a gift. Subsequently, it sold to the public in 1995. Then there was, of course, going to be a plaque with all the names of the people we have. And we did very well on that. And that worked out very nicely. And we had a large committee. We had a working committee of 6 people. But I remember going to a board meeting, and I got up and told them that we didn't know who to put on the committee. But the logical person, our group, to appeal to was the Board of Trustees. So I asked them if we read the names, would they volunteer to see those people and get a commitment from them? Whatever they could do, some $1,000, some only $10 possibly, some gave us $5,000, some gave us $10,000. But we did that, and I don't think that of the 50 people that were on the board that night, I don't think more than 5 or 10 people had any fundraising experience. But it was good for them. And they were selling, selling something they believed in, the temple.
Is your favorite organization or institution the temple? What's your favorite?
No. My favorite is Jewish Community Center.
Oh? Why?
Well, first of all, I like to help kids. Stanley Grossman was chairman of a committee to raise $100 a year as dues to help the community center survive. For some reason or other, people were not in the best of mood when you came to discussing the center. And I would call it sort of a second-hand group.
The center, you mean?
The center.
The center is kind of the stepchild of the community?
It was then. Well, Stanley came to me and said, Bertie, I want you to become chairman because we need this $100 for operating expenses. And I've done it for several years and I'm not getting any place. Maybe you could do something. Well, I took it. And we got the $100 from over 100 people. But then we started a campaign amongst those who are interested in building a new Jewish community center. And ultimately, we got the approval of the Federation to have a campaign. My co-chairman at that time was Merrill Hassenfeld and Eddie Safranco. And we had a fundraiser that had been hired, professional, and we had raised our first $1 million. And we were having an affair at the Biltmore to celebrate when we learned of the war against Israel at that time. Everything had to stop. Now, when you start to pick up the pieces and start a campaign, it's like starting from the beginning. We decided to go our way without the fundraiser, which was expensive. And we managed to raise another $1 million. And we didn't have to pay the overhead, of course. But by that time, the expense of building had gone up to such a point that we had to cut back on the size. And it's unfortunate because today the center is doing one wonderful job. Every inch of space is being used. They get it from youngsters, the kindergarten group, I think they have 5 groups there, up to senior citizens, to people who are blind, using the swimming pool. They spend some time there. And they do an awful lot of good work. And Lola Schwartz is a wonderful leader, an executive director of the community center. I think that was probably my first love.
The Jewish Community Center. But the Jewish Community Center, per se, is very hard to interpret, I think, in terms of the Jewish community, because if you took the health center, the health aspect of the center away, what would be left?
Well, first of all, it isn't Jewish.
Precisely.
I mean, a lot of the members are not Jewish, but they like to use the gymnasium there. They like the swimming pool. They like the activity. They have a group of people there, elderly people, where they meet every single day and they have meals brought in. They have a good time. And I think they serve a very unique position in the community, and I think that they're doing a great job.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear it. So your pet was, and still is, the Jewish Community Center?
Mm-hmm.
Now, from your vantage point, having had all the experience that you've had through the years, what do you think of the next generation that's carrying on? Do you think they're seeing things differently from the way you saw them?
Let me tell you what I think about the next generation. Now, I take as an example our board of trustees at the temple. Today we have mostly young people as trustees, and they have done a splendid job. They're willing to take over and do what is necessary. They have groups get together. They're turn it into a religious group in some instances. This is quite necessary. And they're getting a very good response. And we are getting many new members. You know that we have today at Temple Bethel close to 1,200 members. We have the largest Sunday school in the state. It's the only one of any size. I think today, I'm not sure the figures, but I think it's over 240 students who meet not just on Sundays, but during the week as well.
So then you are very optimistic about the future.
Oh, absolutely.
You think that the leadership is in good hands and we have nothing to worry about.
Well, when you talk about leadership, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about the leadership of the young people that have taken over, supposedly.
I think a lot of it depends upon who the president might be. We happen to have a woman president. She's doing a good job. And
not necessarily the temple. I'm talking about the Jewish community in general.
Oh, I think your younger group has stepped in and done what is absolutely necessary to raise funds for Israel, for example, the Jewish Federation. I think the family service, Jewish Family Service, has done a great job in taking the Russians or Germans or whatever foreign country they come from, getting them a home to live in, an apartment usually, getting bedding and clothing, a job, and teach them English.
So you think that the future is in very good hands?
I think they're in excellent hands.
What do you? What would you say if I said your the accomplishment or the achievement that gave you the most satisfaction in your career in the community? What would you say it was?
I think building the Jewish Community Center.
Because you saw
one.
It go from scratch. Is
That's
that
right. Well, because there was so much apathy at that time against the center, which has been fused into now willingness to work and give. And we made our goal. And we've got something there opposite Brown Stadium that is, I think, active and living. And I like to see these kids do a great job. Now, I have been connected with other organizations where I can see the leadership is good. I'm not a part of it. I'm getting to the age now where it's about time I stepped aside and relax.
I think so, too.
Don't forget, I'm 85.
You don't look it, Bert.
I'll be 86 in June.
You look like the eternal juvenile.
Well,
that's for the record.
look, I've contributed where I possibly could. I'm very active at Brandeis University. I'm a fellow at Brandeis University. And I represent Brandeis in Rhode Island with several other people like Jimmy Winston. And
So you think the picture is rosy? You don't see anything
that means
shadows anywhere?
No, I can see a lot of things that are happening that might be troublesome.
Like what?
Well, for example, what happened in Los Angeles.
You're translating it in Rhode Island terms?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it could happen here. I remember a play they once had, it can't happen here. But it did.
Certainly did.
Now, right now, they love us as Jews. But a time may come when that will be all change. I don't think it will happen, and I hope it won't happen, but it could happen.
In your career, through your vast, wide career, have you ever come across anti-Semitism?
No.
Not once did you ever feel that you were excluded or you were part of maybe a comment that might have been slipped?
The only time I can remember, and it wasn't anything directed at me, but I know there were certain organizations or certain clubs that Jews were not welcome.
Well, you mentioned the Hope Club.
Yeah.
A few minutes ago. What about the Hope Club?
Hope Club is one of them.
Why would you meet there at the Hope Club?
Well, only because the president called the meeting. He was a member. And they had members, much to my surprise, for 10 years before that.
At the Hope Club?
At the Hope Club. But I don't like the place. I still don't like it. And I still wouldn't want to have any meetings there.
Why would Jews want to be members of a club that is so well known as being indisposed to Jews?
Why would I don't.
Then why would any Jew want to do that, you think?
Well, sometimes they think they're breaking the barrier.
They're trailblazers, yeah. You mean.
And, I mean, for example, Arthur Levy was a member of the Hope Club.
That was interesting.
And there are several others. And I think the reason they joined is because they hoped, they were probably approached by
people.
You
think as token Jews?
Yeah, you can call them that. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be a token Jew. Mm-hmm. I want to be recognized because I'm an American. And we all stand together. We all should do whatever we can. And when I read in the paper today of all the different groups of people, lawyers and judges of all faiths, taking bribes, now being possibly sent to jail for a number of years, I'm happy that so far, at least, we haven't had that particular problem with prominent Jewish people.
We've had some Jews.
Some Jews, but minor ones. I mean, there was one, but I think he, who was on the board, as soon as he found out what happened, he was on the board of a bank, and he had taken money out of the bank just before it closed. He gave that money back right away.
What I'd like to do now is returning this tape around.